Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Associate Professor Maha Bailey in this episode. Maha is Associate Professor of Practice at the Center for Learning and Teaching at the American University in Cairo. She's an active critic and enthusiastic supporter of online learning, who describes herself as a learnerholic, writerholic, and passionate, open, and connected educator. Maha and I talked via Google Hangout. I'm talking now with Dr. Maha Bailey, who is Associate Professor of Practice with the Center for Learning and Teaching at the American University in Cairo. She has a broad range of research interests, including open and online education, critical thinking and critical pedagogy, intercultural learning, citizenship, and higher education. Maha, it's lovely to be talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. Lovely to be talking to you too.
Maha, can we begin with a brief overview of your career and publications?
I've been thinking and writing about online learning since maybe 2006. When I was doing my master's of education in e-learning, and I did that master's online with the University of Sheffield. And then I started doing my PhD, and in my PhD, I focused more on non-e-learning kinds of things. And towards the end of it, I realized I've been having problems with the dominant positivist discourses about educational technology, so the techno-positivist views, and I was trying to move away from educational technology altogether as I got more into critical pedagogy and caring about social justice and education and things like that. But towards the end of my PhD, I discovered open education and MOOCs, and through MOOCs, I discovered other kinds of online and open education. And I also discovered a journal called Hybrid Pedagogy. And Hybrid Pedagogy takes a critical approach to educational technology, and they call it digital pedagogy. And so a lot of my publications are either on open education or taking a social justice view or a post-colonial view of open education and MOOCs and online learning and things like that. Through MOOCs, I got into like connectivism and connected online learning. And I've got a couple of collaborative autoethnographies on the experiences of learners in that kind of environment as well. And that research approach is in itself, for me, a social justice-oriented, you know, a participatory research approach. So I was not very happy with other approaches to researching learner experiences in ways that were more extractive. And I prefer that the learners themselves have the power and the voice to talk about their own experiences. So I also do that. Like I said, talking about equity and social justice, I also co-founded something called Virtually Connecting, which we can talk about later if you want, but I've also got a few publications on that with my other volunteers who work on it with me. Moving away from the regular educational technology literature and looking at the literature that talks about empowerment and relationships between learners and students and, you know, just learners with each other, I think it's very important when we insert technology into education that we preserve those human elements. You know, there's this stereotypical view of online education that it is less humanized, that there is less human contact, that there is less affection. And that doesn't have to be so. So I think if we come back to our own values as educators and think about why am I in the field of education, what kind of relationships do I want to have with learners, what kind of relationships do I have with my colleagues, and then you think about how to do that online. It's not that you think that online is going to remove some of this stuff and just accept that. To be fair, I've had a lot of online learning experiences where this effect was very strong, and Virtually Connecting, which I'll talk about in a second, is all about preserving that social and affective aspect of our online and hybrid communications. And it's more complex to do online, but if you care about them in your own classroom, then you find ways to make it happen online. Virtually Connecting is built on the importance of human relationships. Virtually Connecting tries to give people who cannot attend conferences in person the opportunity to have informal hallway-type conversations with people at conferences. What happens is that we have a lot of face-to-face professional development opportunities, and people network in those opportunities. Yes, we have Twitter and we have social media where we network throughout the year, but in those face-to-face conversations that happen when people go to conferences, you build a lot of social capital beyond the online And people who never go to these will never build that. So there will always, they will always be outside of that. It's like a kind of academic gatekeeping. But Virtually Connecting asks people at conferences to come in and have those conversations with folks who can't be there. And they'll sit and focus with you for like a half hour, an hour, talking about what's going on at the conference. And then, you know, if you do enough of this, you don't miss out so much on that social capital, and you build relationships, and you can build on existing relationships or you can build new relationships. And it sort of breaks down the barrier between people who are very high profile, who are like keynote speakers, and people who are like graduate students who wouldn't otherwise ever have an opportunity to talk to that person because they can't afford to go to conferences and they wouldn't be courageous enough to try to talk to that person on Twitter or email. And so it sort of breaks down that barrier. I can tell you the story of how it started. I got really, really into Twitter, and I started doing connectivist MOOCs. I was part of a MOOC called Rhizo 14 with Dave Cormier. I organized something called a Twitter versus Zombies game that was a Twitter-based game with Pete Roraba, who was also part of Hybrid Pedagogy at some point. And I was part of this the organizing committee of a conference. And I had a lot of presentations with all these people that I'd been working with online, and I couldn't make it to the conference face-to-face. And what I was missing out on was not presenting with others, because you could record a video or just join online. You know, that's not a problem. But I was really missing out on, oh my God, I'm not going to see all my friends that I've been getting to know over all this time. And so they made me co-chair of the unconference committee, but I wasn't going to be there. So my friend Rebecca Hoag, who I'd met through Rhizo 14, the MOOC, said, I can be your buddy on site, and I can let you connect with people through my phone or my iPad or whatever. We could have done this just between her and me, that, you know, when she's with someone, she'd call me and I'd talk to them. But we decided to make it on Google Hangouts on air and allow other people to watch and to join those conversations. So basically, that very first time, it was called ET4 Buddy, because it was the ET4 online conference in the US, and it wasn't called Virtually Connecting yet. What we did is that we'd organize at a particular time of the day, we'd tell a two or three speakers, can we connect you with Meha? And we'd organize that, and I'd let people know on Twitter, hey, we're going to talk to this person, and if you want to join, let me know, and I'll send you the link to join. And we did that, and we live streamed it. People got so interested in it that everybody was like, are you going to do this again? Are you going to do this again? And we grew from there so that it wasn't just Rebecca and me. It was anyone who's going to a conference that others wanted to go to who couldn't. And we'd organize sessions and meet with people. And now we have a team of over 50 people. And I say over 50, these are the ones who are still active. There are people who come in and go out. Sometimes someone is interested in just one type of conference and then they don't come again. Or some people will come every year at a particular conference. And there are people who are active throughout the year. Right now, we've connected with conferences in South Africa, in Egypt. We've done several in Europe, several in the US, several in Australia, a couple in Japan. Mostly educational technology conferences. Some of them are more towards open education. Some of them towards, for example, using towards language learning. But there's just a community of people who either want to go to conferences and connect with virtual folks, or virtual folks who really want to be at a conference and we find someone at the event who's willing to connect us. And what we've done slightly differently than when we started, it was all about the keynote speakers and the prominent people at the conferences. But now it's also about marginal voices at conferences that sometimes, like students or people who we wouldn't normally be able to connect with, and getting them in that way. So for example, some African scholars don't have very good internet connections at home. So it's very difficult to get them virtually. But when they're on site in a conference in Europe, then we get them, because that's a good opportunity to talk to them. And one of the interesting things that happens in Virtually Connecting sessions is that when there are edtech conferences that are very corporate or very technopositivist, the conversations we have on Virtually Connecting are dissenting and trying to critique what happens at those conferences. So, and some of them are really cooperative. There are some conferences who give us a complimentary registration to have us do this, because they've started to realize that, first of all, live streaming sessions is okay, it's good, it's great, but it's not the same as these conversations that we can have. It doesn't reduce people's interest in going to conferences face-to-face. Some people were worried that why would you go face-to-face if you can get virtually connecting? But the truth is, the more you do virtually connecting, the more you know about conferences and you realize that you want to go, because everybody would rather actually be there in person.
I'm sitting here smiling with the cleverness of that idea. And also, too, I'm caught by the irony of using technology to critique positivism.
Yeah. We use Google Hangouts on air as well. Like, we're joking about surveillance, and we're like, in this surveillance machine, you know? You know, the more you do this, then you become really close to each other, and I'm very well connected. So a lot of times the keynote speakers are my friends and we can joke around. And that's nice to watch and it's nice to be in. But if someone is outside of that circle, then you're not promoting equity or social justice that way. You're just making them feel like they're on the outside looking in, and that's not what we want to do. We want to get everyone in if possible.
I love the way you're taking your value set and actually applying it. I mean, it's such a practical thing that you're doing there with Virtually Connected. It is an absolutely brilliant initiative. Maha, you've got a very broad range of research interests, as mentioned earlier. What are some of the key themes that actually arise from that work? Well, what are some of the themes that tie all of that work together?
I would say one key thing is just my context as an Egyptian academic in an American context, because it's American University in Cairo, right? So that sort of allows me this hybrid perspective of what it means to be in a global South context, but also to be very, very aware and very connected to the most recent advances of what's going on in other spaces. And so the equity and social justice perspective sort of comes naturally to me. And then understanding it in different contexts like South Africa or India or even in rural areas of the US and so on becomes really natural for me. And the other thing that I think I talk about a lot, and I think people listen to me a lot, is just generally this approach to inclusion and diversity that is critical. Because a lot of times, inclusion means welcome to what we have created, come into what we've created and join. And the problem with that is, and I always give the examples of tables, right? That we say, come to our table, who's on the table? But I'm saying, who created the table? Who decided what the rules are on the table? And things like, what is on the table and what are the ways we're going to deal with what's on the table? How much participation do those who come new to the table have? How much power do they have to change what's on the table? And this happens a lot with foreign funding, for example, is that you get the funding, but you have to follow the rules of the people who gave the funding rather than what your context needs. So, you know, words like inclusion and diversity can be such, people pay so much lip service to that, but how does it look in practice and how do you actually make it work out? Cheryl Hodgkinson-Williams calls it parity of participation as one of the things that you need to strive towards. And I think always be critical that you're probably never achieving it, but just keep working on it. So with Virtually Connecting, we're always doing research to figure out what we're not doing well and what we're not doing right and how can we change it. And never just celebrate. Yeah, just this, not taking the superficial approach of celebrating diversity or celebrating inclusion, just recognizing that you're never going to achieve it and keep striving towards more.
I'm deeply interested in that theme. I like your description of building the table and helping others be involved in the setting, not just the participation, but actually the setting in which they participate. Have you seen this done well? And if so, what does it look like in a higher education context?
I think Virtually Connecting tries to do it well. A lot of people who join as participants who are just on-site guests or they are virtual participants who are just joining a session, if they do it often enough, we invite them to become part of our team and to volunteer with us. And when they do that, they can change the landscape. So, for example, we currently have those regional leaders. Three of them are working together to improve the processes of Virtually Connecting. One of them has been with us for a very long time, and she's a co-director now. Her name's Helen DeWard. One of them, Nate Angel, is relatively new. I think he's been with us for just a year, but he's been reforming the processes and taking feedback from the community in order to improve the processes. And so people at, you know, with different levels of involvement can jump in and go really deep into improving things. And the spirit of it is to where everybody gets an opportunity to participate. And for example, when someone comes into a Virtually Connecting session and they blog about it, even when it's critical, sometimes we republish it on our own blog because we think even when people are critical of it, we'll take it and we'll keep it so that we remember. When we've done research about it, we've researched it with people that we know love it, but also with people we know who don't love it. And there's a lot of people who understand what we're trying to do, but they're very critical of how we do it. Others have said that, for example, it sometimes reinforces cliquishness because there's a particular group of people who generally do Virtually Connecting. And so others who don't understand what it is don't know how to participate. So we keep trying to change that, like finding ways of welcoming people more explicitly, finding ways of welcoming people in last minute who didn't realize what it was. We've been trying to do what we call fishbowl sessions at conferences where you show what it is and allow people to walk in if they want to, and then they can join sessions later. So that's one of the things. Another I think that I've been participating in that sort of tries to do this as well, is Equity Unbound. This is an equity-focused, open, intercultural, connected learning curriculum that I'm doing with Catherine Cronin from Ireland and Mia Zamora from New Jersey in the U.S. And basically what we've done is we've created an open curriculum that others can use or jump into. And the idea of it is that a lot of intercultural learning experiences that happen at the moment are usually in closed spaces, and they don't take advantage of the participatory open learning that we have been benefiting from as educators for our own professional development. And we'd like our students to have those opportunities to connect with others via Twitter, via collaborative online annotation with things like Hypothesis. And at the same time, a lot of intercultural learning, there's a lot of power dynamics involved in that kind of thing. And if you don't explicitly talk about equity issues, they might be ignored. And so this curriculum is basically what I do in my... I teach digital literacy more than educational game design these days. But it does have game design in it, but it's a digital literacy course. But it's got an intercultural focus as well. And we talk a lot about empathy and bias and equity directly and things like that before we get into the details of digital and intercultural learning. And so this curriculum gives opportunities for people to join in at different places and to contribute their own ideas for how to do things and their own resources for them. And so just because, simply because the three of us, like in Ireland, in Egypt, and in the US, are involved, that's already just given three world views about the topic just to begin with. And then when we came to decide what kind of material we're going to use, we were very, very conscious that the readings and the videos and so on would be from different parts of the world. So we have Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie from Nigeria, and we have Lina Munzer, which was one of our key readings, and she's Lebanese. And trying to make sure that we have that diversity. And then we also had studio visits by guests, again, making sure that we had a lot of women, a lot of people of color, a lot of people from different places in the world, and never to have like a talk with all white men or something like that. And at the same time, having other educators who are participating and want to participate in this to be able to contribute their own activities. And still you have to welcome people in a lot more to get them to contribute. Just because you say you can contribute doesn't mean people will contribute. You have to like ask them directly, hey, you know, for my own face-to-face course, I've asked my students as an assignment to contribute something. And so now I have a large bank of student-contributed things. So throughout my semester, sometimes the students would, while we're talking about something, say, hey, you know what? I have a video that you might want to use in the class, and I'd use it right then and there. And there are a few who've done that. But then, you know, some won't do that unless you prompt them and ask them and give them, you know, reward them for doing it. And so I did that, and I've come up with some really, really good stuff that I think in the future, next time I teach this course, I'm going to use.
Great. So you're being intentionally diverse in how you design things, and you're also being deliberately welcoming with your class and with your students.
And I think also open to criticism is really important. So some critiques are welcome and some critiques can be abrasive. So we've had a couple of critiques that were really good. We do something called a Twitter scavenger hunt where people post pictures of things. One of the issues someone said is, what about accessibility? Like if you're focusing on images, then what about people who have visual impairment? And from that discussion, and especially if you're going to talk about equity, you really need to think about disability. And so from that discussion, we learned about using alt text descriptions of images on Twitter and how to make that your default. And we wrote an open letter from people in the Unbound Deck community to Twitter to make it the default. I mean, it's possible to do on Twitter, but it's not the default. Why not? Why don't you make it the default, you know? We had a critique about how the facilitators were not responding enough to people who are participating on Twitter. And that we felt was a little unfair because we never said this was a MOOC. We said, we're teaching our own thing, but we're making it open for other people to join in if they want. We never said, we're teaching you. We're teaching our courses and we're just, you can join in if you want. And talking about pedagogy of care, which is one of the articles I wrote about on a massive scale, is that when there's a lot of other open educators, they support each other. The facilitator doesn't necessarily have to be the person who's doing all the care work. We're all educators, we're all adults, we're all able to give that to each other. And the facilitator doesn't necessarily have to be the person to do it every time.
Maha, it's a sign of a great educator that I'm actually reflecting quite deeply as you're talking. So I've often been caught by this thought of never being diverse enough, never being inclusive enough. I think what you're saying is that's not necessarily a problem, provided you're taking steps to become more inclusive, to embrace that diversity a lot more and to keep learning and to keep improving.
Yes, yes. And I think also just recognizing that, keep thinking about it and knowing that you're never going to be enough.
Right, and always learning from the critique that you receive.
Yeah, it's also important to look about you and see who's around you, because if you're always surrounded by a particular type of person, you're not going to hear the critiques that you need to hear. You know, I was thinking there's a prominent group of people in the community that surround themselves with people who look like themselves, you know, white North American men or whatever. And so you'll get critiques, of course you'll get critiques, but they'll be easy for you to understand because they're from your own circle. But if your community around you is more diverse, then you're going to hear critiques that are more diverse, and they might be difficult to listen to and difficult to understand. I once wrote an article about the unbearable whiteness of EdTech or something. And what I was writing about in that article was, count on one hand how many, if you can count on one hand how many people of a certain other minority are your close friends, that you know them well enough. If it's less than that, then you don't understand that group of people. So for example, for a lot of my friends, I'm their only Egyptian friend. So all their perspective on an Egyptian perspective is Mahabeli's perspective. It's not a general understanding of how that kind of person thinks. And so if you, for example, create a board, an editorial board for a journal or a conference committee, and you say, oh, I'm including women and I'm including LGBTQ people and I'm including international people. But if you have a committee of like 15 people and there's two international people, five women, one LGBT person, you're not really including them. I mean, you are, but it's a token thing. You got one person. And so you're not really getting a diverse perspective if the rest of them are all white men or whatever, you know? So surrounding yourself with people who can give you a different perspective is really important.
Yeah, I'm really struck too by your whole approach to humility, vulnerability, and social connectivity. There's a mindfulness of others, which I think is coming through quite strongly in this conversation, which I really appreciate. Maha, we're coming up to the end of 2018. There's only a few weeks left now. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time?
I think maybe the one thing that comes to mind a lot is a lot of the extra institutional directions towards online and open are going in very different directions to the inside the institution types of things that are still quite closed and concerned about copyright and perhaps very maybe neoliberal in terms of measurement and trying to sort of tick some boxes and things like that. I mean, as someone, I work at a faculty development center, so we support people in developing online learning. And I think a lot of the times, what I learn from working in the open doesn't easily transfer to what's happening in the institution because of the cultures in the institutions are so close to that and they're so unaware of that. And it's very tricky because sometimes you're working with someone who's going to develop an online learning experience who doesn't themselves, or who don't themselves have a lot of online learning experience, or all of their online learning experiences are with open things. And when you develop a closed, paid-for type of online learning, you need to think about it differently. So it's just trying to both benefit from what someone would learn if they learned in the open, but also trying to design then paid-for, closed, four-degree or four-credit experiences. So there's, I think, a lot to learn from trying to pull this all together into something that's coherent and contextualized and flexible, and trying to find that is very, and it's also very rare to find someone who writes about all of that in one space.
It sounds like you work hard to bridge those two elements, though, that the openness, but also the institutional, the commercial, the closeness, if you like, of a university. Do you think you get it right? Do you think you do it well?
No. I don't, because I'm very, very radical in my work outside the institution. So I struggle very, very much. I mean, one of the people who does a really good job of bridging those two is Robin DeRosa, who was at Plymouth State University. And she talks a lot about how the work we do in the open is relatively easy because we have no one stopping us really from doing it except ourselves for the most part. Whereas the work in the institution, you have to work within the bureaucracies and you have to struggle to convince a lot of people who have more power than you. I mean, when you work in the open, you sort of, Bonnie Stewart talks a lot about in her work about how Twitter and social media has their own reputational, taxonomy that has nothing to do with the hierarchies inside our institutions. But a lot of us who do a lot of this work in the open and we're quite well known and we have a lot of social capital online don't have that much power in the institution. So you have to struggle a lot to convince people who have no idea what the heck you're talking about, because this kind of thing is really difficult to imagine if you've never done it. Online learning alone is difficult to imagine, but open education and that kind of thing is way, way outside of most people's imagination. And then, of course, you're working with instructors or faculty, professors, who themselves are nowhere in that area, and you're trying to help them find ways to connect with their students online. And they're like, I know how to connect with them face to face, but how am I going to do it online? And they don't have that experience as learners to be able to have that experience as teachers. And then trying to get them to imagine it before they're designing their course. It's really, really, really difficult work to do. And as a good educator, you know that telling someone is not the same as them experiencing it. And so it's kind of difficult to navigate this, really.
Just going off script a little bit here, I know that one of the benefits that people talk about for online learning is its scalability. And yet in being scalable, we can lose that interpersonal connectivity that you've talked about earlier. Is scalability almost like the enemy of what you've been talking about?
I'm not sure if it was Doug Belshaw or someone else who said that scale doesn't care and care doesn't scale. And this is actually one of the things we struggle with virtually connecting, is that more and more people want to have virtually connecting at their conferences. But if we grow too fast, then you end up having people volunteering who don't really understand the ethos of what we're doing. And then therefore the experience becomes just a mechanical connection of groups of people without being that hospitable, equity-focused kind of thing. But I think between scaling and non-scaling is distributed type of scaling. One of my problems, I think, is the assumption that scale is... reaching more people doesn't necessarily mean scaling it in a way that people are distant from a facilitator, is what I'm trying to think about. So like distributing facilitation would allow for some level of scaling. I'm going to give you an example of something that really gets on my nerves, and it's for refugees, especially they talk about Syrian refugees going into Europe and developing MOOCs for them and online learning experiences and apps. And I'm thinking, aren't there like Syrian adults that you could help recruit and train them so that they can then work with their communities instead of offering a MOOC? And so you can offer the MOOC for the content and then train Syrian facilitators who are the educators or the elderly and or whatever, then to work with the younger people, So there's somewhere in between that is scaling the things that can be scaled, like content, and then working in the middle way to have some kind of level of facilitation that is closer to the ground and that then works with smaller numbers of people to help them work together, especially when they're not adults. I think adults can self-organize with a little bit of help. I think there are a few MOOCs where they ask groups to self-organize. And that's also not a bad approach, right? Like, we're making some stuff available for you all to use, and then you can organize yourselves in smaller groups, whether online or face-to-face, to make it a more intimate experience.
Great. Maha, if you had an unlimited budget and the research team of your dreams at your disposal, what research would you most like to see them participate in or do?
I'm going to give a local example of something that I'm trying to do, but I think it can be done in different pockets and brought together to share good practice. So I don't believe in best practices, because most problems that are important don't have a very easy solution that applies to all contexts. But there can be pockets of good practice that someone can then transfer parts of and then recontextualize. And so I'm in a situation here in Egypt where at the K-12 level, which is not the level I work at, but which I think needs a lot of work, because education here can really needs a lot of work, where they want to integrate a lot of technology solutions to problems that are much, much more complex than needing technology with them. You know, at the same time, there are a lot of space and time restrictions, which I think is why they're trying to bring in technology. And the problem is that you're in a situation where people have very different access to technology and infrastructure, and there's a very big socioeconomic gap. So where people are really, really poor, it feels really, really complicated to give them iPads, and that iPads are going to solve a problem, because the curriculum itself needs a lot of work, and you know, adding technology into it is not really going to solve any of the problems. But there seems to be this global direction, and it relates to, I guess, both policymakers who don't understand education and funders who don't understand education, to infuse technology to solve problems that don't need technology to solve them. So I'd like to see maybe research into trying different kinds of things where you know that you're going to get funding to do technology, but you find ways to reform the curriculum with the technology so that the technology does have a good impact, even though the real change maker is not the technology, it's the other thing. But also, how do you make sure that equitable access to that technology, and not just access as in having the device, but also the culture and the social environment around how do you use that technology and how do the teachers use it in the classroom, so that you use it in the best way possible, and avoid things like creating students who are just consumers of content, but also producers of content. There's sometimes what they do to avoid internet problems is to give people downloadable content. And that's very, what's the difference between downloaded internet content and a textbook? The whole point is the open internet and being able to find your own material. But then also a lot of the material that's already out there is in English and it's from a Western perspective. So how do you also use technology then to help expand what's available on the internet to the local needs of these different communities?
So it's a very broad contextual study. It does sound very, very useful, because it certainly takes away from the techno-positivism that you were talking about earlier. You're now talking about the situation in which these are used and how they're used to perhaps amplify the student experience rather than just replace what might be, as you said, just a textbook or access to content. To finish with, just two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning. One whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now. One who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
I would say Cheryl Hodgkinson-Williams from University of Cape Town in South Africa has influenced me recently a lot. Like I was saying, her work on social justice in open education. So she's been involved in, I think she was the principal investigator of ROAR4D, which is Research on OER for Development project, which was across a lot of institutions and countries, and trying to see openness and how it works in the context of various emerging economies. And she's co-edited a volume on this that's really worth looking at. And just her work on this idea of parity of participation and the social justice angle on that has been influencing me a lot. Another person who I haven't mentioned before, Sava Saheli Singh, is, I think, of Indian origin, but I think she lives in the US or Canada right now. And she takes a critical perspective on educational technology. And even though I haven't read a lot of her work, I've interacted with some of her work, it again takes a really, really good critical perspective on all the different angles that we can take when thinking about open education and education technology in general.
Maharis, it's been wonderful talking with you. You are certainly a leader in online learning. I've learned a lot over this conversation. Thank you very much for joining me for the program.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really enjoyed it. I think you've made me think a lot about where I'm coming from again and why I do what I do. And I'll keep thinking about some of these questions as well.
You can find Maha's profile and links to her work from our website. Her Twitter handle is Bailey_Maha. It concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.